Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show. On KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the latest on proposed legislation to fund Chase Field renovations.
And a career-saving elbow surgery for baseball pitchers is increasingly popular with teenagers.
But first, as it often does, Arizona recently found itself at the center of the national political spotlight. Two of the biggest names in progressive politics came to town. And Sam, you were there, yeah?
I sure was. Microphone in hand.
All right. Well, tell us what you saw.
Last week, some 15,000 people gathered at ASU's Mullett Arena for a rally with Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Walking around the third deck of the arena, I met a woman named Shelley. Shelley's been having a rough time.
It just feels like the air has been completely sucked out of everything, and it's scary and it's sad.
Shelley came to the rally with her friend Jen, but Jen didn't want to talk on mic.
She is feeling so depressed she can't even speak.
Ever since President Trump was reelected, Shelley told me, she and Jen have been despondent. They came to the rally hoping it might lift their spirits.
Trying to find some optimism in this ugly, awful orange mess that we're in. Just looking for other like-minded people.
Based on the conversations I had that night, Shelley and Jen were in the right place. In fact, I think it's safe to say they were surrounded by about 14,998 like-minded people.
Donald Trump is driving a steamroller. It's unbelievable what is going on now, and it feels vastly different and almost at the point, like a tipping point, where we may not recover.
It's overwhelming. It's really hard to just soak in what's happening to our country right now.
Oh, it's gotten scary. It's getting scary. That's about it.
Some of these people were upset for very specific reasons. They were furious about President Trump's attempt to get rid of the Department of Education, or about Elon Musk's cuts to government programs. A handful said they were hoping Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez would provide a detailed playbook to block Trump and Musk from carrying out their plans. But the vast majority of these people just wanted to feel something, anything other than what they've been feeling.
I just want to feel relieved. I want to feel seen.
Trump is such a crook, and he just hurts everybody that he can. And I'm so tired of it. I'm so incredibly tired of it.
I want to get everyone fired up. I want to see people get mad.
When I was younger, I always expected the world to just get better and better as time passed by. And I'm just shocked that it's just not happening.
The rally began with a series of warm-up speakers. A pair of veterans from the Marine Corps and the Air Force railed against the Trump administration's proposed cuts at the VA.
We swore an oath to the Constitution, to each other, and to this country, and that oath doesn't freaking expire. Trump wants us to sit down. We say hell.
A public school teacher sounded the alarm about the privatization of education.
Because our schools are not for sale, our kids are not for sale, and our communities are not for sale. It's time, all of us, to stand up and fight back.
As each of them spoke, you could feel the anticipation building in the arena. And when the teacher finished her speech, she sent the place into orbit. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez walked on stage. She wore a button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled up and a pair of jeans. She stood at the podium, lifted her arms, and greeted the crowd.
Are you all ready to rock? Are you all ready to take our country back? We're gonna throw these bums out and fight for the nation we deserve.
Even though it was clear that everyone in the room knew who she was, Ocasio-Cortez introduced herself. She was there, she told us, not just as a congresswoman.
I come to you as a friend. As a friend. You know, my home in New York is a ways from here, but in truth, I love you too. The distance between us.
Her speech didn't offer much in the way of strategies to disarm the president's agenda. Instead, she offered empathy.
And I understand what it feels like to watch all of this stack up. I understand how overwhelming it can feel. And it can make even the best of us want to give in to despair, to feel tired, to feel like there's not much worth fighting for. It's hard to feel like anything you do matters. It's hard to feel like we matter.
She offered rage.
And I don't want us, I don't want any of us to live like this anymore. We deserve better, Arizona. We deserve better than this.
She offered a vision.
And I don't know about you, Arizona, but I want to live in an America that guarantees health care to every person. I want to live in an America that has a living wage for every person. I want to live in America where you have free speech to express yourself.
As Ocasio-Cortez spoke, I couldn't help noticing how different the scene was from the last time I watched a Democrat address an arena full of supporters, which would be the final days of the Kamala Harris presidential campaign. Those Harris events were so carefully stage-managed, so tightly scripted. And at this rally, there were no teleprompters. Ocasio-Cortez almost never used the word you, only we and us. There wasn't a pantsuit or a necktie in sight.
See that this movement is not about partisan labels or purity tests, but it's about class solidarity. It's about the thousands of you.
And this is just my opinion, but the other thing I couldn't help noticing is that if I were producing the Fighting Oligarchy tour, I would have had Bernie Sanders speak first, before Ocasio-Cortez. When Sanders finally came out to close the show, the applause was loud at first. But the longer he spoke, the more it felt like he was basically playing the hits from his 2016 and 2020 presidential campaigns.
We will not accept a society today in which we have massive income and wealth inequalities, where the very rich have never done better while working families are struggling to put food on the table.
At several points, Sanders decided to take suggestions from the audience, and you could feel the energy in the room drain as he tried to wrangle the crowd.
How many people right here in this arena have high deductibles? What kind of deductibles do you have, ma'am? One at a time. Seven. 7,000 deductible. Other deductibles? Yeah.
Now, no one would deny that many of the 15,000 on hand at the Fighting Oligarchy rally were there because of the movement that Bernie Sanders started. But to my ear, the rally made it seem like the future of that movement belongs to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. After the speeches, I heard a smattering of complaints about the lack of a concrete plan to make Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez's vision a reality. But most of the people I spoke to were ecstatic. They didn't come to the rally looking for a message. They came looking for a messenger. And I want to play you one last moment from the event. It happened at the very end of Ocasio-Cortez's speech. She was in the middle of a sentence, and an audience member shouted, "My queen."
But we share a lot of the same experiences. So, your representative.
A state Senate committee yesterday gave its okay to a bill that aims to keep the Arizona Diamondbacks at Chase Field by helping them fund stadium repairs and improvements.
But the panel made a number of changes, although not enough changes, to bring Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego on board. The proposal would allow the Maricopa County Stadium District, which owns the facility, to keep sales tax money generated at the ballpark. That money would then be allocated for work to be done on the stadium. Wayne Schutzke from KJZZ's politics desk was at the Capitol yesterday to attend the committee hearing. He's here now to talk about what happened. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So let's start with how broadly would this plan work?
The basic idea is that the bill would allow the stadium district, which is like a subset of the county that owns the stadium, to capture sales tax at the stadium for games, events, what have you, everything people are buying there, and use that money, put it into a fund to pay for repairs for things like the air conditioning system that, everyone who's been to a game knows needs to be replaced, plumbing, all the different repairs the Diamondbacks say are sorely needed at the stadium.
Is it mostly repairs the team is saying they need? Like, are there other sort of improvements? I mean, there was talk at some point of possibly having to build a whole new stadium.
Yeah, I mean, they've mainly been focusing on the infrastructure needs. The stadium's going on 25, 30 years old at this point, and so they've really kind of honed in. But the bill doesn't actually specify exactly what this would go to, which is actually a point of contention with Mayor Gallego. I think a lot of it would be focusing on something like that air chiller system, which you can imagine would be extremely expensive to replace or repair for a major stadium like Chase Field.
Sure. So the initial version of this bill included sales tax revenue, but also income tax revenue, right, for people who worked at Chase Field, including the members of the Diamondbacks. That was one of the changes that was made, that was taken out. What other changes were made in the committee yesterday?
Yeah, that was one of three changes they made. So they stripped out that income tax part. They also put a cap on the amount of public funding that could be used, so the amount of sales tax that could be captured over the 30 years that this would cover, at $500 million. Now, that's adjusted for inflation, so $500 million in today's dollars.
Okay.
And then there was like some language added that would require the county's portion of the contribution from its sales tax to equal that of what the city, kind of equalize the contributions between the county and the city.
Okay. So supporters of this bill are basically saying, and the team is kind of saying, that we need this to stay in downtown Phoenix, right?
Yeah. So the lease at the stadium expires in 2027. So Representative Jeff Wenninger, who sponsored the bill, said, we need this money in order to make sure that they want to negotiate a new lease.
This money is going to enhance an asset that they do not own and that they've already put over $200 million of their own money into an asset that they do not own.
Yeah, so the Diamondbacks have said we've already put money, as Wenninger said, into this stadium over the years. The Diamondbacks contributed something to the construction originally beyond what the taxpayers did. And so he's saying, they're not going to want to spend any more money on this thing they don't own unless we can promise them that, the public's going to come to the table and help out.
Okay, so speaking of the public coming to the table, one of the main critics of this bill is Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego. One of her big concerns, it seems, is that this bill, by taking sales tax money and giving it to the stadium district, means it's not going to the city of Phoenix.
Yeah, so that's the whole idea of the bill, is you're diverting the sales tax away from where it would originally go to.
Yeah.
So not only the city, but the county and then the state would all be losing their portions of sales tax that are on things that are sold there. And as Gallego and some others pointed out, the city of Phoenix also doesn't own this stadium. So she's not asking for the plan to be scrapped altogether, but she does say that it's putting a little bit too much of a burden on the city right now.
This bill will cost Arizona taxpayers $1 billion, even as amended. And the Diamondbacks won't be paying half. In fact, they're not required to pay a single dollar.
So when she says that $1 billion, that's talking about that inflation adjustment. So they're basically projecting out over 30 years that $500 million could become $1 billion, and a couple hundred million of that would be coming from the city. She wants to see a cap that's lower, and that requires the Diamondbacks to meet the public halfway and contribute to this project.
Did she have a figure in mind of what a lower cap would look like that she would get behind?
What she has said to me is that she wants to go with kind of this figure that legislative budget analysts initially pegged the impact of this bill to be at, which would be around $450 million. And I think that's all in, so not just the city's contribution, but that's the total, which would lower, I think, the city's contribution substantially down to maybe around $100 million.
Okay. And presumably, I would imagine she's nervous about what the city would do with that much less money, right? Potentially, you know, $500 million over 30 years.
Yeah. Wenninger said that, you know, we've added provisions to the bill that gives the city a little bit of discretion about which funds this money is pulled from, it basically to protect police and fire, public safety, that they're not affected by this. But Gallagher said even in the event that that happens, there's still tons of other city programs, stuff that help, you know, parks, kids, potholes, all this different stuff that different aspects of the city sales tax pays for could be impacted by this.
So the bill won support yesterday in a Senate committee. It was bipartisan support, but not unanimous support, right?
No, yeah, it was a bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition.
Yeah.
It's one of those unique situations that where politics becomes a circle and you see folks on kind of the far of one party and the far of the other coming together. We saw Jake Hoffman vote no on it, who's, you know, part of the far-right Freedom Caucus, along with several Democrats. Hoffman didn't explain his vote, but the Democrats basically said, you know, this is too much of a giveaway to a billionaire owner. Those supporters would then say, Diamondbacks don't own the stadium. So it's kind of that push and pull of, this is technically a publicly owned stadium. What responsibility does the public owe to keep it up versus the team that's making money there?
Based on folks with whom you've spoken, does it seem as though this new version of this bill, obviously, if it clears the Senate, it has to go back to the House because it's been changed in the Senate. Does it have support to get to the governor? And do we have a sense of what the governor thinks of this?
I think it's hard to say whether it has support. As you said, the old version passed through the House, so I imagine it would still have the support over there. But the loss of folks like Hoffman really eats into Republicans' majority over there. You know, they only have a two-vote majority, but then you have a certain amount of Democrats who are willing to come on board. So it's really hard to do the math about which Democrats are off this, which Republicans are off this, to see if they have the 16 necessary to get this across over to the governor. And then the governor's really given no indication about whether she is going to sign this. She's obviously very friendly and ally with Mayor Gallego, but she also doesn't want to lose the Diamondbacks in Phoenix. And so all she said right now is she hopes they come to a deal all sides can support, which I guess is kind of the goal, but not usually what happens with legislation.
Absolutely. All right. That is KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke from the Politics Desk. Thanks, Wayne.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the nature of boredom and ways to find engagement in something more meaningful.
But first, President Trump this month signed an executive order calling for getting rid of the Institute of Museum and Library Services, or IMLS, quote, to the maximum extent of the law. The IMLS awards grants every year. The congressionally authorized institute's mission is to advance, support, and empower America's museums, libraries, and related organizations through grant-making, research, and policy development. Last year, Arizona got nearly $4 million in grants from the IMLS. The money the state has gotten over the past several years has paid for projects including the Arizona Memory Project and training and books for libraries in Yavapai County. Jason Makoviak is library manager at the Copper Queen Library in Bisbee, which was awarded a national medal by IMLS this past year. He was at a recent gathering at ASU with institute officials to talk about the future of libraries. When he got home from those meetings, he heard the news about the executive order. When I spoke with him recently, I asked what IMLS has done for his library.
So the way that IMLS handles their funding, so they distribute federal funds to state libraries. And then libraries like ours apply to the state library for grants. So over the years, we've used that process to apply for federal funds to do things that we normally couldn't do within our own city budget. So for example, that was 6 years ago, we applied for a grant to open up what we call the Copper Queen Library Annex. And what that is, it's an offsite location in a neighborhood that's farthest away from our main library. And it's a neighborhood that also borders along Naco, Arizona, as well as across the border to Naco, Sonora. So without that funding, we would not have been able to do that. And that's just a really good example of what kind of impact that the loss of IMLS will have on libraries like ours. So over the years, we've also applied for grants to update a really outdated health collection, expand our children's library with great nonfiction resources for kids in our community and our homeschool community. We've used federal funds to start our internet hotspot program. And that's a program that allows us to literally check out the internet to our patrons. So those are just some of the things that we have done with these federal funds. And I know that the Arizona State Library also uses those funds to do a whole array of things that every library in Arizona benefits from.
Well, so yeah, what would that mean for you going forward if that money were no longer available? And I wonder if it's maybe a little bit of a different impact, given, as you say, it's more of a grant-based thing than sort of a yearly supply of money that you're counting on.
Correct. Yes. But the great thing about this program is that libraries of any size can come up with a really great idea that for a service or a program that they can implement in their community that benefits their patronage. Also, we're talking, I think the budget for these federal funds are about 0.003% of the annual federal budget. But when you look at these programs and services that libraries have created, the return on investment is huge. So it's really taking this pot of money and making it available for all these community resources that impact, you know, a lot of our city people. It's a hard thing to think about, and I don't think we're quite at the point where we know how it's going to affect future funding, but I know a lot of my colleagues, both within our county system and throughout the state, are very concerned about the potential impact on just how we serve our communities.
Are there particular projects that you were already sort of drawing up ideas for that, hey, if we could get this grant from this program, we could do this? Or, like, is there a concern that stuff you've already done, some things maybe you mentioned already, like things that you maybe were hoping to get some of that grant money to continue paying for? Like, are any of those things potentially in danger?
So, yeah, so just looking at this year, we're planning on submitting some grants to extend our internet hotspot lending program. We're also looking at creating an AV type space, where multi-purpose space, where we can use that space to do telehealth. People can do private Zoom calls from that space. People can use it as a recording studio. We can record podcasts. People can come in and record music. And that was the next big project we were looking at doing. So if these funds were to somehow disappear, we would have to try to figure out another place to get those funds.
Well, I wanted to ask you about potential other sources of funding. Like, are there any, like, especially in a small rural community like Bisbee, like, are there other places you can look for money?
Well, this one is the easiest to access. So yeah, if this were to disappear, we would have to try to figure something else out. And that does get challenging when you're in a small and rural place where there are not bigger pots of money to draw from.
Yeah. I'm curious about sort of the role of the library in a community like Bisbee. And you referenced this in terms of maybe putting an annex in a part of the town that is far away, or having mobile hotspots so people who don't have access to the internet can get it. What is the role of the library in a community like Bisbee?
So our library over the years has really transitioned into a really useful and used community space. So, you know, a lot of people think of libraries, they think of them as just repository of books. And yes, we have books, but we have so much more than just books. Over the last few years, we have created a library of things, which checks out non-traditional library items, stuff like a ukuleles and blood pressure monitoring kits. You know, people come to us for information and resources, so we can refer people. If we don't do something here in the library, we can certainly find somewhere in the community that does. So we've become really a trusted spot with our community. And just in terms of community building, we love the, you know, we're not a shushing library. And actually sometimes we get in trouble for that, but there's a reason for that. is because we're trying to build community. We want people to come in and talk with their neighbors, talk with their community members. You know, we feel like that kind of fostering really leads to a tighter-knit community. And, you know, the more you talk with people, the more you realize that we have more in common than we have not in common.
Do you have a sense of, like, what percentage of the library's budget usually comes from the IMLS? I know that it can sort of vary based on the amount of grant money you get year to year, but, like, is this a significant portion of your budget that could potentially be going away?
So just take this year, for example, and we're putting in for about $10,000 in federal funding for some things that we want to do. So that was just this year when we applied for a grant for the Open Up the Annex. That was like a $25,000 budget. So it depends year to year what we're doing. But, you know, our budget's only over $200,000 annually. So if you look at something like a $25,000 grant, that's a big percentage of our budget. And especially if the state library loses their resources, we use those resources all the time. All types of things that potentially would be gone.
All right. That is Jason Makoviak, Library Manager at Copper Queen Library in Bisbee. Jason, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. If you are a baseball fan, spring training is a time of hope and anxiety. Every morning, you scan the news nervously, dreading the two most ominous words a headline about your favorite pitcher can contain: elbow inflammation. Throwing a baseball places an extraordinary amount of stress on the human elbow. And increasingly, the dreaded inflammation is a precursor to the even more dreaded ulnar collateral ligament surgery, which is sometimes called Tommy John surgery, after the first pitcher to receive it. The procedure takes a pitcher off the mound for more than a year. They basically have to relearn how to throw. But as devastating as the surgery can be in the short term, it can also save a career. And because of that, it's becoming more and more popular. Hundreds of pitchers have it every season. In 2024, two pitchers per week on average. On March 14th of this year, the D-backs announced that one of their top prospects, Blake Walston, will miss the entire 2025 season after going under the knife. For a long time, Tommy John surgery was considered a last resort. But nowadays, it's not uncommon for pitchers to have it twice over the course of their careers, and teenage athletes are getting it on a regular basis, believing it can salvage their dreams of a multi-million dollar major league career. So, is all of this major surgery a good thing? Josh Husted is an orthopedics professor at the U of A, and he's performed a lot of TJs. He says kids are playing so much more baseball early in life that the rate of elbow injuries is exploding, and that athletes should understand exactly what the procedure is before they have it.
We take a ligament from another area of the body, usually in the hand and the wrist, and we weave it in between the two bones, and we put an anchor on one side and an anchor on another, and we reconstruct the ligament. We then let it heal in, rehab the player, and for most people, they're able to come back very well.
And what is the reason that it takes so long to recover from that particular procedure?
Scar tissue is a really interesting thing. The first layer of scar tissue kind of lays down very disorganized. That happens within the first 6 weeks to 3 months. But then the scar tissue actually aligns with body stress over time. And that process takes about a year. So even when I'm operating on somebody anywhere in the body, but particularly in the elbow, I'll tell them you're about 80% better at 3 months, but you're about 90% better 6 months and 100% better at a year, because it takes that amount of time for that scar tissue to realign according to the stress that you're doing. And that's why it takes so long for the pitchers to return. There is a push to do more repairs and augmentations. So something called an internal brace, which is a suture that goes over the top of a repair. So instead of taking everything out and starting over with a reconstruction, there is a push in younger athletes to just put in this suture augmentation with an anchor on either side and use the suture instead of a tendon.
Why is that more appealing for a younger player?
So it's a much quicker return of function. Mm-hmm. So I'll put two instances in front of you. You are a junior pitcher, and it's your junior season, and you really want to play college baseball. And you have an ulnar collateral ligament injury. And you have to choose between getting a internal brace suture augmentation or a full reconstruction. The internal brace may allow you to return in maybe even 3 months and pitch the remainder of the season. The reconstruction is going to take you out the entire season. For that athlete, they may be much more interested in getting back and getting a college scholarship and getting into college. And that recovery time, the reduced recovery time, is more important.
Gotcha.
Versus, you know, let's say you're a major league baseball player, you're going to get paid on your contract regardless. And your whole goal is just to throw 100 miles an hour again.
Yeah.
And you're willing to give it a year. Maybe a reconstruction is a better option for you. Most of the athletes that we see that are getting these repairs, they're wanting to get back as soon as they can and kind of feel out whether or not baseball is going to be a full part of their life or just a part of their life for the next little bit.
Well, that's one of the things I was wondering is, let's say I'm that pitcher who's about to, you know, play my junior year of high school, and it's more important to me to stay on the field. Let's say I believe that baseball is going to be a part of my life for the rest of my life. I want to go pro. That's part of my goal in getting back on the field and getting a scholarship somewhere. If I get that internal brace procedure, am I putting myself in danger of doing even more severe damage further down the line?
Potentially, and I would say it's more theoretical than it's a pretty new procedure. So we don't know what the total long-term outcome of that's going to be. Now, I will say that the initial studies are very promising and people have been able to return and pitch very well after a repair. It's not as simple to just say repairs do worse and reconstructions do better. It also depends on the amount of injury that the patient or the person has and not just the amount of time that they want to get back.
Gotcha. I know that you're an orthopedic surgeon and not a psychologist, but since you are also a former athlete at a very high level, I would imagine you know something about the competitive headspace and the level of drive that young athletes have to have in order to entertain dreams of doing this professionally. I guess what I'm saying is I feel like a lot of folks at that age, you know, 16, 17 years old, have maybe never really had a serious conversation with themselves about what they want their 30s and 40s to look like. They've just thought about shooting baskets or throwing pitches.
Just tomorrow.
Yeah. So how do you approach those conversations? Is that something that you have to think about?
Yeah, I mean, that's the hardest thing that I do. And luckily, I always have their parents there. And luckily for me, I just tell them my experience, right?
Yeah.
I was a high-level athlete. I was one of the best in the world. Actually, I was ranked 15th in the decathlon in the world. I got second at the NCAA championships.
Wow.
And I got really bad problems. And,
okay.
You know, I was supposed to have surgery on my elbow and I was a 22-year-old Yahoo and I was just, you know, doing whatever. And I was very passionate. And I had to make a decision if I was going to do that professionally or if I was going to go to medical school. And I went to medical school. And so maybe I wouldn't have known, right, when I was that age, which direction I was going to go. But I just try to tell them, hey, now I don't throw at all. I didn't have surgery and I do great in my daily life. And I just say, why don't you guys have a full conversation? We don't decide this in one sitting. Why don't you go home and talk as a family and really kind of decide what you want to do?
Boy, I'm just mortified envisioning you sitting with one of these kids, maybe talking to them for the first time about the possibility that their dream is not going to come true. I mean, is that a situation you found yourself in?
All the time.
Yeah.
And
how do you get through that? I mean, geez.
It's the hard, like I said, it's the hardest thing that I do. So it's very easy for me to see somebody with a broken wrist and tell them, hey, your wrist is broken, look at the x-ray, let's fix it. Mm-hmm. It's very different to have an honest and open conversation with somebody about what their future looks like when in reality they don't know what it is. My goal with my patients is that it's a patient choice. My job is to educate you on what your options are and then to support you with the best option that you choose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not easy.
Yeah. What do you think should be done about this? Like in these early stage sports leagues where kids are starting down these paths that you've described of playing one sport to the exclusion of others, what do you think?
This is just the doctrine of Josh, but I do think that it's good for kids to do cross training. So particularly when they were young and when I was an athlete, I spent a lot of time cross training to try to keep my body fit and not to overwhelm any one particular area of my body. And I think that if you're a parent and you're hearing this, I would just strongly encourage your children to continue to participate. It doesn't have to be in other sports, but just not going out and throwing hard every day. When you're developing, particularly between the ages of 12 and 16, your body has a lot of changes and maturation that's happening during that time. And it's good to just try to be as global as you can and have them participate in other activities other than just throwing.
Take it from the decathlete, right? There's more than one way to be an athlete.
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, Josh Husted, Assistant Professor of Orthopedics at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Anyone who's ever been on a road trip with kids will have heard the phrase, "I'm bored." But what exactly is boredom and what causes it? And is being bored always a problem? My next guest says boredom is neither good nor bad. It's just a signal in your body. And we may not really understand what boredom is as much as we think we do. James Dankard is a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Waterloo in Canada. His lab researches boredom, among other things. He joins me. And James, let's start with how do you define boredom?
Yeah, so I define boredom as a motivational state. It's wanting, but failing to engage well with the world. So when you're bored, you really want to be doing something that's meaningful, that's purposeful to you, but you just don't like any of the available options. And the quote I like most comes from Leo Tolstoy from Anna Karenina, where he describes boredom as the desire for desires. And that really captures the conundrum of boredom, that you want to be doing something and you want to be doing something that matters to you, but you just don't like any of the available options.
That's an interesting way to think about it. And I wonder because, like, especially for kids who say, "Oh, I'm bored, like there's nothing to do," I wonder how much the desire to do something, that desire for desires matters, as opposed to maybe just not liking any of the options, but just not having anything to do and not being able to come up with something that will keep you engaged or entertained.
It's common for kids to say things like when they're bored that, you know, there's just nothing to do. And, you know, the knee-jerk reaction that most parents take is to trot out all the options that we know exist. You know, go play with your Legos, go outside, play basketball, do something with your siblings, whatever it is. And at every turn, the child dismisses those options, just says, "Nah, I don't want to do that." But what they're saying is, you know, they've looked at the options. They see them. They're not silly. They know that there are things out there that they could do. And those things might have worked in the very recent past for them to be engaged and engaged well. But right now, they just don't want it. And that kind of highlights another aspect of boredom that I think is really important. And that is the need to be able to be in control of your goals and in control of your life in that moment. So when we're bored, it's pretty obvious to us that we're not being very effective. And it's the same for the kids. You know, when they're telling you that they're bored, they're not going to accept your solutions because they come from you. What they need, what boredom pushes you to try and do, is to come up with a desire of your own. And when you can't do that, that's when boredom is most painful.
What is going on in our brains to make us bored or to at least make us say that we're bored?
Yeah, so there's not as much data on what's going on in the brain as I would like, but there is at least a little bit. And what we showed, we put people in a magnet, an MRI machine, and we made them bored. We did that by making them watch an 8-minute video of two guys hanging laundry, which, believe me, is a very effective way of making people bored out of their skulls.
Sounds scintillating.
So we did that. And what we found is that a range of brain areas that form a network known as the default mode network were activated. Now, what this network is all about is sort of self-referential thought, which is very true of boredom. You know, it's I am the one who is bored in that moment. But also you see this network of brain areas activated when there's nothing external for you to do to engage with. The important thing in our study is that there was something for you to do. There was a movie to watch. It just turned out it was so mind-numbingly dull that you instead turned inward to that default network that normally is only active when there's nothing to do. Hmm. There's a lot more work to be done, though. And, you know, one of the other things that we found is that another really interesting part of the brain known as the insular cortex was downregulated. So it sort of showed less activity when we made people bored. And this part of the brain is really critical for representing things that are relevant to you and for sort of exploring your world for something engaging to do. And so clearly when people were bored and they had nothing that they thought was engaging, this part of the brain sort of turned off in some sense.
That's interesting. I'm wondering if you think or see the nature of boredom changing, perhaps. And I ask because, you know, you mentioned that it's, you know, nothing that you can think of to do seems engaging or, you know, is, you know, in the world of things you want to do. But most, if not all of us, carry these giant entertainment systems in our pockets now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems like if you are bored, like you're standing in line. I can't tell you the last time I saw someone standing in line somewhere who wasn't with their nose in their phone, just kind of looking around. And I wonder if that does something, if that changes somehow what boredom is or maybe how we respond to it.
But the first thing I would say about that is I don't think it changes the nature of boredom itself. Because boredom is this signal telling you that you need to do something else. You need to engage in something more meaningful than whatever's right in front of you. Certainly, you know, I often have people say to me that how could you possibly be bored given that you have the world at your fingertips on your phone? And the thing about that is that kind of way of engaging your brain, of just turning to your phone, scrolling through your social media feed, is quite passive. And that's not a good solution to boredom. It might occupy your mind for a moment, but as soon as you put your phone down, whatever made you bored beforehand is still going to be there.
Do you think that boredom gets a bad rap?
I don't really think that boredom is bad or good. I think it's just a signal. And so maybe it gets a bad rap, but I think sometimes it also gets an artificially good rap. So I'll tell you what I mean. It can get that bad rap in that we blame it for everything that we find distasteful. I don't think that boredom can be blamed for those sort of things. It doesn't make the choice of what to do. It just tells you need to do something. And the flip side is where people sort of think boredom will somehow magically make you creative. But creativity is complex and creativity is difficult and takes practice and it takes a lot of, you know, exposure to new techniques and new ideas and this sort of thing. And it's really a complex human behavior, creativity. And you can't hope that somehow embracing boredom for an hour a day is going to magically make you creative. It won't do that.
Well, so what you said about the creativity is interesting to me, especially because, yes, I think you're right that a lot of people will say, you know, hey, I just stare off into space and these great ideas come to me. And that never would have happened if I'd just been staring at my phone or watching TV or doing whatever. But I wonder, based on what you said, if that's maybe a misinterpretation or a misunderstanding of what boredom actually is, because it seems to me that if you're sort of, even if you're staring off into space, you're actively engaging your mind to come up with the creative ideas.
I think you're 100% correct. So when people say, my mind was drifting and I wasn't doing anything, and so I let boredom in and I became creative. No, you didn't let boredom in. You disconnected from the world in, you know, an intentional way, let your mind wander, and it was open to different ideas, and that led to whatever it led to. But that's not the same as boredom. It comes back to the definition that we have. Boredom is this agitated, restless state of wanting but failing to engage. Well, you can't be restless and feeling bored and at the same time happily letting your mind wander to discover new things and new ideas. Those two things are antithetical to one another.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you hear often from people who say they're bored when in fact they're not?
I don't hear a lot of that. There's on occasions I've had, you know, one or two people say something like, you know, I like being bored. And then you probe a little bit and you ask a few questions. And what they like is they like being disconnected. They like some downtime.
Yeah.
And I think we all like a little bit of downtime. And then the other thing that happens a little bit more commonly than that is I hear from people who say, I never get bored. And again, if you just probe a little bit, you find out that, yeah, actually they do get bored, but it tends to be a really fleeting state for those people.
James Dankard is a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Waterloo in Canada. His lab researches boredom, among other things. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.